The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in one place. And so this week, Brian Dowling joined me in studio alongside dance partner Lauren Nolan after the return of the dreaded dance-off saw him hang up his dancing shoes on Sunday night's Dancing with the Stars. Fiona Fagan spoke to me about the need for more kindness on social media after the tragic death of her friend Caroline Flack. Anne Napolitano talked to me about her new book, Dear Edward, which tells the story of a plane crash with just one survivor and what happens in the aftermath of such a tragic event. Alan Crockwell and James Healy told me all about the Mixed Ability Rugby World Cup, which is promoting inclusion and equality in sport. And Terence Monaghan is the Chief of Department at the NYPD. He told me about the long tradition of Irish-American officers in the force and the many changing faces of the Big Apple as he was rising through the ranks. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy. At 9:34, it is that time of the day where we have to introduce a little cha-cha-cha.
Dancing with the Stars on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Muller Corner. Mullerlicious.
Brian Dowling and Laura Nolan live in studio.
Good morning to you both.
How are you?
I love the song When Doves Cry.
Yes.
I loved what they did to your hair last night. Yes. I mean, it was pretty dramatic. Spectacular.
You should have seen me try to wash that out at midnight.
I get the braids out.
Was it hard?
Yeah. It was all my own hair, can I point out. But also, they sprayed it slightly darker to make the blonde, make it look more rooty. And then when the water was turning black, I was like,
What's happening?
She sprayed my hair. Caroline sprayed my hair.
That's funny.
One thing I think quite enjoyed was as much as the dancing is important, Laura is a world champion, is that we liked the look of almost becoming different characters every week, and that was the best part of it, right?
Yeah, we on a Monday we used to say, now what we'll have our hair like,
we did.
Makeup,
costume,
it was a whole thing.
Maeve,
we used to think of it as a production, it wasn't only a dance.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, certainly last night was, you know, you burst down, I was going, this is great.
I mean, it was full on.
It was full on. But because I don't understand dancing, I couldn't necessarily then understand why you only got the scores you got. I thought it deserved
I don't
more
understand
than
that. I've got to pass that to Laura because this is her world.
Were you surprised?
To be honest, I thought it was a very underworked. I like as a pro, I didn't go easy on him. I definitely gave him really difficult choreography, and I thought he could have got a little bit higher, to be honest.
Yeah.
I don't know why it was so underscored, but sure, it is what it is.
That's what I keep saying to everyone.
I always think that in that situation, as I've said to everyone, I wanted to get to a certain point, but I always think it's other people that feel awkward as opposed to you, because people just want to say the right thing and they don't upset you.
Sure.
But you know, I've been offered the show before and I was always like, no, no, no. And I think it happened for me at the right time.
Yeah.
And I loved every, and we laughed.
Yeah, you looked like you were enjoying yourself.
We enjoyed it.
Every single day.
Yeah,
we laughed
such a positive experience.
I think you were very vulnerable through it.
Yeah.
Because of different weeks that we had and things like that.
Yeah.
But it was, at the same time, it was amazing.
Yeah. And we spoke on the Late Late recently about your same-sex dance that was a bit of pop cultural history in Ireland.
Yes, it was
so
amazing.
You stayed long enough.
Do you know,
it was always
the goal to do that, and then to be able to do it, and it was welcomed in such a positive way, and it was like a big kind of celebration. And you know, the ripple effect of that is I'm still getting people talking to me about it. You know, and to be able to have done that on the show and then come back with you and do what we'd done last night, you know, was amazing. Yeah. But like, it is what it is. It's part of what the show is.
Sure.
I've done reality before. I know how it works.
Alien says, I'm disgusted to see Brian
She's disgusted.
Leave dancing as he was a breath of fresh air and didn't deserve to leave the show. I mean, yeah, and but there's nothing we can do. The votes are in.
Unfortunately,
it's been counted and verified.
Yes.
It is what it is.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
Can I ask you about Caroline Flack for a minute?
Yes.
Because I know that Fiona, who we spoke to earlier on, is
lovely
styling
Fiona.
You guys at the moment, as it turns out.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about you this morning and how, when you first got into Big Brother, I mean, I don't think Twitter was...
No, I mean, we just spoke about it. I was on, my first reality show was in 2001.
Yeah.
There was no Twitter, there was no Instagram, there was no Snapchat, there was no nothing. I then had done other reality shows. I'd done Hell's Kitchen, which was a very intense experience. Again, I think maybe Facebook around that time, there was, I think, Bebo, you know, MySpace, you know. Yeah. And then when I'd done Ultimate Big Brother in 2010, I think it was like the time of Twitter.
Yeah.
And when I left that show, it was kind of Instagram. So I kind of have done all those big reality shows at a time where there was none of the nasty side of it, you know, with people saying and kind of doing it. And now I think it's the point where it's escalated so aggressively that it's so shocking as to what happens and what people can say.
Do you read the comments under your...
Do you know what? I don't sometimes... I think if your name's attached in something, it's almost like you're getting a text message. If they at your handle, and I do read that. Like, you know, if I get 100 nice comments and I get 5 bad ones, the 5 bad ones always resonate with me, and I don't know why that is.
I'm going to do a thesis on it someday, because I have to try and figure out why is it that people, regardless of them being well known or not, will get, somebody will say, I love your dress, I love it. And why will you take the one person who says you look manky in that,
but why
and
do you
take the one home?
I know, I agree with you, but I don't know what it is, because it's just something about it that maybe you overanalyze it. And I used to get comments about my weight all the time, or sometimes my sexuality, or the way that you look, and you take them, and sometimes they're really hurtful, and people need to realize, just stop, just don't do it. Think, why write
it's
a nasty
very strange
message?
Because I think that if it wasn't behind a phone or a computer, people wouldn't say that to your face.
But again, it's
very, very strange. Yeah. It's very strange that people would say bad things like that, because I know that they probably wouldn't like it said to them. So.
It always reminds
me of... They
need
to really think about what they're saying.
Exactly.
What they're writing.
You're quite right. And it reminds me of the film Frost Nixon, where David Frost is interviewing President Richard Nixon. And they were... It was almost... Because obviously that was in the 70s, or maybe into the 80s, but the 70s certainly, where they were sitting down and part of the film crew had gathered around to meet him. And one of the guys was saying, I hate Nixon. I can't look at him, the head on him, the way he walks. I don't even want to speak to him. I couldn't even look him in the eye. And as soon as Nixon comes into the room, he shakes his head. Hello, Mr. President. Mr. President.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I often think that he was trolling him before he came in.
Didn't.
And then you met him.
Yeah.
And he says, actually, look at you. Flesh and blood. Hi.
I know. It's very strange. Bad. I think that's showbiz though as well. Do you know what I mean?
Do you know what? We might all do a bit of that ourselves.
Yeah. There, do you know what? I always think sometimes, you know, we may not all like each other, and you may not get on with everyone all the time. But since losing Mom, I'm very now aware of how I treat people and how I want my interaction with people to be as positive and as polite as it can be. No one knows what's going on behind closed doors. We just don't.
For sure.
You can meet someone and not know what people are struggling with. And just be kind to each other. Just be tolerant and just be a nice person.
Do you get much flack, if you'll excuse the expression, poor old Caroline Flack, do you get much grief online about your
personally,
clothes or dancing or anything like that?
Personally, thankfully, I haven't had very much at all. Of course, there are those few comments which I've seen, but I just try to fought it off and look at the positive things. But I do know that other pros in the last few weeks have got quite bad comments and have taken it quite personal.
Yeah.
So thankfully, no, personally, I haven't had that much. But anything that I have seen, I've just tried to ignore it.
To rise above.
It seems to be just the intensity of the unpleasantness is an issue when you think of people from Love Island who I think have taken their lives by suicide.
Yes. Yeah, there was, I think there's been two. And now, of course, sadly,
Caroline,
it's so strange. You know, I've come from reality. It's how I started. And again, you just don't know. And I think sometimes when you go on reality shows, I think people think it's free reign. You've put yourself in a position to be judged. Yeah. Look, I was running around a house naked, screaming for 10 weeks back in 2001. Listen, I understand people can have an opinion, but just be very wary of your words and just be very wary of, you don't know what that person's going through. Yeah. You just don't know.
Or how they'll take to
or
the
how
comments.
You react to a situation, how I might react to a situation. You don't know what, it's just very strange. And I think now though, I especially with the sad loss of Caroline, I think something, there has to be a change.
Yeah, I think
someone has to. Someone has to do something.
It's almost societal change. So
I know.
That's always the hardest one because it's kind of ephemeral. How do you encourage people to be a bit kinder? And I think that one of the things that what you were saying there, Laura, is that if you have something that you say, say Laura came in today and said, "God, your man over these glasses are disgusting. It gives me a pain in my face." Mm. That's fine. And you can say that to Brian as you walk out of the studio. Mm. Then, but when you then sit down and write it and post it for the world to see.
I know.
What happens to the person who was polite a minute ago?
I know.
Who becomes something
different.
Else.
Yeah.
Maybe, you don't understand it.
But maybe it's something in them. Maybe that's the problem.
It's very strange because it's as if people wouldn't really say that to another human being face to face. But not only that, you're wondering, are they thinking if they have children, they wouldn't like that people say that to their children? Or are they saying to their children, well, this is okay. This is the thing. Mm. Is it going down through the generations? Is this becoming a normal thing?
But it's not normal. The thing about it is, though, trolling is becoming a normal thing.
Yes, it is.
Everyone gets trolled. Probably a lot more people than we think get trolled. Like if I was to go on Twitter and probably put in the Dance Minister Stars hashtag, which I've never done and I won't, or put my name in a search engine, I'd probably see horrendous stuff that I'd be really upset about. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to put myself through it.
That's the key, I think, to survive this world.
Totally.
If you want to put yourselves out there, which we all do.
We all do.
In this studio, we do. And you have to take the grief that comes at you. That's absolutely part and parcel of it. Some people can take it a little more than others, and that's also part of the makeup of the human condition. We think we're so sophisticated as a text and we've made so much progress in our world, but given the opportunity, it's amazing how we are transported back to gladiatorial times, reality TV and social media being the perfect vehicle for all that sort of thing. So look, and a lot of people writing in to us about that, but back to the Dancing with the Stars, if I may.
The gloves are off now.
Brian, thank you so much. Our family really enjoyed your time on Dancing with the Stars. You danced brilliantly, so that's to you both, of course.
Let's
have a little look down at the likes of Lottie would be doing very well now with the numbers. Ryan is doing very well with the numbers.
Yeah.
Aiden's doing well with the numbers.
Love Aiden.
There's a few then kind of middle rank, and then Father Ray is still hanging out there.
I know.
Give us your thoughts on these.
Do you know what? The thing about Father Ray is, but I call him Ray. I don't know why I just said Father Ray. I'm calling him Ray all the time. Him and I, you know, wouldn't necessarily have ever met before apart from the show.
Yeah.
Same with Michael Caruth. So it puts you in a situation of people you wouldn't necessarily meet. Yeah. But Ray actually has improved.
Yes.
If you look at him from week one to week seven last night, he's getting better. And that's what the show's about. But also, the public decide who they want on or off the show. So at the end of the day, you've got to give the public what they want, and they want Ray dancing, and that's what it's about.
Yeah.
And he's a nice man.
And the thing about it is, yes, it is a dancing competition, but it's also an entertainment competition. And I have to say, he's very entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
And everyone is enjoying.
He's funny.
Yes, he's actually quite funny. So I think you have to remember that too. It's an entertainment programme, an entertaining
But also if you look at the likes of,
you know,
Grainne, for example, you know, like in Aiden and Mary coming in with zero dance. They've never
100%.
Done anything. And to see Grainne and Aiden and you know, and Mary into the level they're at now. And that's what the show for me is about, is giving people who've never done it before, you know, the opportunity to because you're trying to learn a new skill. That's the thing. But you're almost like, feel like, you know, when you ever get a dream when you're going into an exam and you don't feel, you know, that's what it's like every week.
Oh, is it really?
Yes, seriously. The music goes on. And I think I danced two or three times even with the rehearsal. And then I was like, I still didn't get it right. It's so strange.
It's a very daunting experience for someone who has never done it before.
Yeah.
And every week you've 4 days, 3 or 4 days to learn a whole new routine. Mm. So I have such respect for those who have never done this before and is really putting themselves on the line. And then you have also the added pressure that it's live.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's fully live,
It can go amazing in rehearsals all week and you go down to the studio on a Saturday and everything goes.
I used to get, do you remember my issue was, I can't swim or drive and I've no sense of direction. But I would, my spatial awareness would go off. So my left in the Liffey Trust studio would be my left, but then in the studio I'd be looking up at the ceiling.
Actually, we had like a little incident, remember, on a Saturday. So funny. It was week three and we were supposed to finish back on the
stage.
And I kept saying to him, Brian, he lifted me and he was going closer and closer to the camera. And he couldn't understand.
Brian,
and then he dropped me down and he goes,
sorry.
I was wondering why you were talking to
but
me.
But also,
so much.
The stuff you learn 1 week that you learn, try and do 8-10 hours, you learn, have it. Then the next day, like, forget all that and now do the opposite.
Yes.
So it's very strange.
I think
like
you can be, you can be actually lucky with what dances you get.
Yeah.
That they can actually have
consistency,
the,
or
more of a consistency, and it kind of connects.
I wasn't lucky. I didn't have a connection.
So it went from the salsa to the American smooth, which is like, No, there's no nothing connects there.
Yeah, totally.
So, like, it's week on week, something new. And yeah. I have to say, the improvement from a Monday to a Sunday was incredible.
Yeah, I mean, we would get like, it on a Monday and I literally would be step. And then a Wednesday, Thursday, you get a bed. And then on a Sunday, it's a whole different show.
Brian, you can put your feet up now for a little while.
I cannot
wait,
Brian.
No,
I want a holiday.
Yeah, yeah, it's on the way. It's
on the
way.
A few drinks.
Yeah. It's all coming at you. Yeah. Laura, you have to keep going and dancing.
Absolutely, yeah.
You're rehearsing this week.
I think I'm going to, I don't know what I'm going to do every day. Not yeah. going into the studio, having the laugh. But yeah. you know, I am still there. I'm going to be doing the pro dances.
Of course
so
you
I'm.
Are.
I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to this week.
It's been great to have you on the show. And of course, you have the concert orchestra there
yes.
on Friday.
Yeah,
sorry,
such a pity.
Sorry,
I know.
Which that
pity.
Didn't make
I know you were
it.
Hoping
yeah.
to get
yeah.
there.
I was. But that's just, you're never guaranteed another week. And I always say my philosophy when I went into the studio the weekend, I said to everyone, this could be our last time doing it. So
when the elimination
go like it's your
started,
last time.
Yeah.
Go and, well, a nice comment says, we need more people like Brian and RTE. Positive, intelligent, humorous and self-deprecating. I have a teenage son and if he turns out as well as Brian, I'll be a very happy dad.
Oh, that's really
lovely.
Nice.
Isn't
yeah.
that lovely? And
that's
Alan really says, nice. Love Brian and Laura and the positive, kind attitude. Sorry to see them both go from the show. So look, there's love out there.
Of course.
For you both. And thanks for coming in to see us today.
No, not
thank
at all.
Yeah, you're really
having
added
us.
To the whole show and
thank you.
We look forward to seeing you before it all ends. In the meantime, Brian Dowling and Laura Nolan.
Thank you.
Thank
good
you
luck.
Brian.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you so much. In other news over the weekend, obviously the shocking story of what happened to Caroline Flack came through. And I did not know Caroline Flack. I never met her. I never spoke to her. I never interviewed her at all. In fact, I didn't really know an awful lot about her other than from a distance. And the girls would watch Love Island and she was very much part of that programme. And she was very much part of British popular culture. And she was in trouble with the law and she was in having trouble, I suppose, online. People were probably being mean to her, but that's what happens, sadly, online. And what was kind of intriguing that was coming out over the weekend and a lot of the response on it was the word kindness. We've been saying it quite a lot here since last September, October, about how the world, kindness is king. And, you know, on this programme and on The Late Late Show, we try to celebrate rather than knock as much as we can because the knocking is debilitating and it's not good for anyone. It's like a virus. It's cruel and it's nasty. And I do bang on a little bit about the online thing, but you know this is it. There was a suggestion over the weekend in one piece that said that once upon a time, you know, somebody like Caroline Flack would have looked at the tabloid newspapers, but she didn't have to buy them. And equally, somebody like her would have to have an online profile and presence. So she would be online on whatever social media platform she's been on. And she would read those things. So in other words, it's not about the papers anymore. This 24/7 following you home, this bullying or just pure nasty, not even bullying, it's just nastiness, will follow you home. And that's what she would have been doing, reading those things. That's why I left Twitter. I mean, not to bring it back to me, but just very briefly. And one of the reasons I left it for several different reasons, but one of them was because people just were unthinking in their nastiness. And you don't need to be, I didn't need a Twitter in my life, so that's why I left it. And I couldn't, it's the most liberating and important thing to do because people will say things that quite simply, I don't believe they'd say to your face if they met you. And that's what happened in people's lives. Sometimes they forget that in Caroline Flack's case, that you have a person, not a TV celebrity, not a dancer, not a presenter. You have a human being who might surprise people, but they have feelings and they have a life to get on with. And you might think it's all glam for her, but clearly she gets hurt and people can be hurtful. And I'm glad to see, and we got a heap of emails over the weekend from people unsolicited to talk about Caroline Flack and to talk about not only her achievements, but also the need for more kindness. It's quite simple. And the kindness comes from us as parents to lead from the front and say to kid, you can't be doing that. You can't be writing that stuff down. And equally, I'm afraid to say, I think the parents sometimes are worse. Sometimes you might see a really nasty comment and you look at the profile picture and it's a dad with three kids. And you're thinking, what hope have the kids got if you're being that horrible? What hope? Let me say good morning to Fiona Fagan. Good morning to you, Fiona.
Hello, how are you?
Good I'm sorry for your loss. You're a former stylist for Caroline, but you're more importantly, you're a friend of hers for 20 years. I'm sorry for your loss.
I am. Yeah, I'm still trying to process it, to be honest. I'm still completely in shock, I think. I just can't believe that this was the end for her. You know, I keep waking up thinking, oh, it's not really happened. You know what I mean?
How did you meet her?
I met her when I moved to London 20 years ago. We were both starting out as dancers. We did like one job together as a dancer. I think it was probably our only job as a dancer when she was trying to be a professional dancer. Mm-hmm. And she then went on to be an amazing presenter, but we just really clicked on the job. She's a real girl's girl. We really got on. We took each other's number and we just remained friends ever since. We went through so much together, roaming around Camden in our 20s, going to gigs, going on holiday, working together. Yeah.
She strikes me, and I was just saying, Fiona, I didn't know her at all. I didn't meet her in any sense of, you know, through work or anything. But I got the sense that she enjoyed life, that she was fun.
Oh, she was good crack. Full of fun. She was great. Her laugh would just have you in stitches. She had this dirty cackle that was just hilarious. She loved fun. She would always be the best one at the party. She always wanted to go and do things. She was full of life. She was full of life. That was her press. She was sparky. You know what I mean? She was sparky.
Strangely, you're in Ireland because you're a stylist on RTÉ's Dancing with the Stars programme, which we'll be talking about.
I am, yeah.
Which is lovely, but had you been in touch with her last week? Or
I messaged her on Friday, just saying I'm thinking of her, that I hope she gets some positivity out of this, and that I said, you're a fighter, you're a pro, you know, just sending you lots of love, but she didn't respond. But that was on Friday, but I've actually just been speaking to a couple of friends over the last couple of days, and she had spoken about taking her life to friends. You know, she had spoken about that in the past, and I didn't know that. You know, so she was obviously in a bad, bad place, but no one thought that it would happen and she would do it. And she, you know, it's just like I'm only finding this out. Like, we've got loads of mutual friends, obviously, in London, and I'm just finding all this out now. It's awful.
It is just so desperate and so sad.
But actually, what I just heard you saying about Twitter, and you're right, like, I have an example of this. It's like when we were doing the live final of Love Island, when I was styling for her for it, like, her mom rang her before and said, good luck with the show, darling. And she was like, no, promise me you won't go on Twitter after the show. Promise me. Because Caroline would go on Twitter after one of the shows and she'd get slammed and she'd be devastated. And she went, no, I won't. And then, of course, the show ends, the live final, and she goes on Twitter. And she gets slammed for the dress she was wearing just because people want to be nasty. And then she was downcast for the next hour.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what
and
you mean.
And the next day.
Yeah.
And so that's what you were saying. It's like, you know, you do go on Twitter. You know, you go on and you see all these nasty things. And it's like, just, you know, and her mum was trying to protect her, saying, don't go on. She's like, no, I won't. I promise me. Because she knows she does it and then she gets so obsessed.
What did you,
you know?
Why did you text her on Friday asking, was she okay? Were you concerned for her?
Yeah, I was. I don't know what, you know, I hadn't spoken to her in a couple of weeks. And I just sent, I don't know. Because it was Valentine's Day as well. And she is a hopeless romantic. And I know she couldn't see her boyfriend. And I know those sort of things. Like when you know her, you know what she's like. She's like this big heart of love and hopeless romantic. And she loves love stories and love movies. And I just thought she would have been. I knew it was Valentine's Day. And maybe I just felt I needed to reach out because...
I wasn't following her story with any serious interest, and not out of rudeness, but just because, you know, I felt it was one of those kind of slight creations that I wasn't that particularly interested in keeping an eye on. Now it's more important because it clearly would have played a role in where she went this weekend and in her heart and in her head.
Yeah.
What was the case, or what was happening with her?
Oh, well, she just couldn't see him because of the whole court case and stuff. And, you know, so she just... I know she was with a friend. I know she was with a friend on Valentine's Day and she spent, you know, the day with a girlfriend. And she thinks she has loads of friends around her. She really does. We have lots of mutual friends. There's loads of people who care about her. But then you can still feel so alone, can't you, when you still have loads of people around you, you know? London can be quite a lonely place. I do think it is. When you're in that spotlight industry and you don't have a partner or a boyfriend or someone to kind of, you know, to keep you grounded, to sort of have your back, do you know what I mean? To support you, you know, it's a really hard industry out there. And London can be a really lonely place.
Why are people so angry about other people's success? Why are people so furious about other people's beauty or glamour or ability?
I know.
What
I
is,
know.
I mean, it's this awful. Is a broader
jealousy
question.
That they're just sitting at home doing nothing and they see someone in the limelight and think, I can take that away from them because I don't have it. I don't know. Is that what people think? I think it is.
I just don't understand it.
I don't either. Because I don't, and it's awful. But it really took her to the ground, you know, it did in the end. It's just... It's awful. You know, she was very insecure. She was very fragile and she was insecure about her weight at times, about her figure. You know, I dressed her, I styled her. You know, it was hard at times because, you know, you're in the public eye and, you know, well, we all feel like that. We all look in the mirror some days and think, oh, God, I'm having a fat day or I'm having a shitty day or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's, you know, when that's constantly in the media spotlight and people are slagging you over it.
But that's like, life. Like, who's gonna, that's it. Everyone. Regardless of whether you're the Prime Minister, you know, the Taoiseach, the President, or, you know, presenter, or if you're somebody who works, you know, down the road doing whatever you're doing or works in a shop, it doesn't matter. The human condition doesn't allow you to be 100% happy all the time. It just doesn't. It doesn't allow you to be delighted with yourself all the time. Can't.
Yeah, I know. I just can't believe that she just thought that there was no other option for her. Like, I'm still utterly in shock. Like, I really am. I can't believe I'm not going to hear her laugh again, or I'm not going to see her, or I'm not, you know, just, I can't, I just, that's in shock, that this is, you know, this is the way it ended for her.
Is there anything, I wonder, Fiona, that people can learn from something so horrible? That's, you know, is there any lesson or any guiding post we can take?
Well, to be kind, which is the things that she said, you know, she's someone's daughter, she's someone's friend, she's someone's twin sister, she's someone's auntie. She's, you know what I mean? It's like, just be kind. You cannot take people down in that manner. You just can't. You can't say those nasty things. You know, there's going to be consequences. People are fragile.
There's a few texts in saying, there's a group, says a text, living amongst us who tear down those of whom they are jealous. Like you just said there, Fiona. Is there a person who hasn't been wronged and hurt by such people? Kindness and common decency must come into play before more people suffer. And Anne was on to say, those girls on your couches on the late on Friday said that kindness was what they looked for in a man. Talking about Caroline this morning, you mentioned kindness.
Yeah.
Let's not make kindness random. Let's make it compulsory.
100%. I hope this is what's taken from this. I really, really do. And because that was a famous sort of quote now that she said, I hope we all take it on board.
What was
and
her
not
quote?
Just
what was
about
quote?
It in 2 weeks time. She always said, it's something that nice to be kind. I think she put it on her Instagram.
Okay.
And we had it actually on Dancing with the Stars last night, and Catherine, someone wrote her quote on the chalkboard, so it was quite nice to see that.
That is a nice thing to do.
But I think we should, that's what we should all take from this, and not just forget about it in 2 weeks' time when something else is in the newspapers, when something else has happened. You know, someone lost their life because of this.
Yeah.
Someone that didn't need to, that was 40, and that would have the opportunity to have kids and find love and fulfill all of her dreams. You know what I mean? It's like, they've lost their life because they've taken their life because of this.
Yeah. That's an interesting text that you might like there from somebody who says, blowing out someone else's candle doesn't make yours brighter, it just makes the room darker.
Mm, exactly.
There's truth in that.
So taken from someone else, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, why would you bother? Anyway, look, it's a bit grim, but it's the truth, so we have to confront all of these things.
Is.
And, you know, we're not blaming anyone or anything for... We're just simply trying to find out what happened to that poor woman and why we're here talking about a 40-year-old, you know, as you say, sister, twin, daughter, auntie.
She was a friend to everyone. She was such a girl's girl, you know. She was like,
You mind yourself, Fiona. It's not an easy time for you. And thank you so much for talking to us today to remember your pal.
No worries. I wanted to say something nice and positive.
And you did.
You know,
and here's to learning and here's to kindness conquering all.
Here's to kindness conquering all. Thank you.
Let's do it. Mind yourself, Fiona. Thanks
Bye.
For your time today. Mind Pleasure yourself. To talk
Thanks.
To you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Fiona Fagan, who, as I say, is a lifelong friend of Caroline Flack and who is currently working as a stylist on Dancing with the Stars here in Ireland. But... as you heard her speaking, a woman who's clearly missing her friend and in shock. Don't forget the Samaritans helpline. I always like to mention it if we're talking about stories like this. And you can call them. It's a very easy number, 116123. 116123. And their email is joe, that's jo@samaritans.ie. And always, always make the call. Let me welcome our guest this morning, Anne Napolitano, to the studio. Good morning, Anne. Thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, congratulations on Dear Edward. What a great book.
Thank you.
I mean, I'm not sure what it's going to do for flyers of the world or people who are nervous about playing, but we'll talk about that in just a moment. Just to, because you've written other books, but because this is the one that we want to talk to you about today, we just want to get a little feel for who you are, if you don't mind. And I'd like to go back to six-year-old Anne being dropped off to the library where you grew up, and give us a sense of what it's like to be that age, going through the doors. What section did you go for? What shelves were the magnets to young you?
Oh, I love that question. I get dropped off once a week, and actually I was such a serious reader that the librarians, normally there's a limit to how many books you can take out. It's like 10 or 15. Mm-hmm. And the librarian sized me up fairly quickly and told me I could take out as many as I wanted. So I used to bring a duffel bag to the library and fill it every week and bring them home and then bring it back the next Saturday. So I kind of read my way through the shelves without any knowledge of the sort of limitations of children's books or genre. Like, I read romance, I read westerns, I read, young horror books. I read everything.
Everything. And did you, I mean, at that young age, not just six, but as you got older again,
yes.
It's one thing reading books for your age or beyond, where you're just reading words and learning words and just thinking it's fascinating. But of course, you couldn't understand them because you wouldn't have the life experience in some respects for them. So, and then sometimes you can go back to a book 20 years later and read a totally different book.
Yes, 100%. I mean, I think that's true, you know, all the way through your young 20s. Yeah. I mean, if you read a book when you're 17 and read it again when you're 27, you're looking at it from a completely different viewpoint.
Yep.
But that's one of the wonderful things. Unless you read a book too young, like, it's entirely possible to read like a classic when you're 12 and not understand it and not like it. Mm. And then you put it aside and think you just don't like that book. But if you just waited a few years, it would have hit you better.
No doubt about it. So we've established your credentials, Anne, as a complete bookworm, which is the greatest thing in the world. Therefore, you're on our bus. Welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Let's talk then about you going into college. You were between 20 and 23. You were struck down by a virus called Epstein-Barr, which I'm not familiar with. Could you give us an idea of what that did to you?
Yeah, it's like, it's, I think you call part of it glandular fever.
Oh,
or,
yeah, sure.
Mononucleosis. Like, it's a, so Epstein-Barr is kind of like the mothership of glandular fever. It's like the bigger version of that. So what it did basically was it wiped out my immune system so that I caught everything that went near me for like a year. And then I was sick for 3 years. It took me an extra year to finish college. And it meant that I had like 3 hours of energy a day, as opposed to at that age, you're supposed to have like 37 hours of energy in a 24-hour day. So I kind of had to pretend to be a 20-year-old when I was around my friends, and then I would kind of like collapse and onto my bed when I was alone. So it made me feel very like other for that period of time.
I appreciate that, and that actually will chime with Edward. We'll get to that again in a short amount of time. But how often would you get food poisoning, for example, with that virus?
Like once a week. It was terrible.
Oh, come on.
That was probably the worst part. No, it was awful.
Once every 5 years is absolutely debilitating for most human beings.
Know.
But once a week?
I know. That was literally the worst part, because you just want to die when you have food poisoning.
Don't
so,
you?
Yeah. And it's so isolating. You're just alone in the middle of the night in the bathroom.
And what age did you feel as a 22 or 3-year-old when all around you were having fun and so on?
I felt like I was about 80. but it helped me. It helped me figure out that like life was short in a way that I don't think you normally realize when you're 20. Mm-hmm. And it made me commit to, I'd always wanted to be a writer, but I think I don't know that I would have had the courage to actually do it if I hadn't gotten sick at that age.
What a weird and yet probably not uncommon way to realize it, you've only got one go at this.
Yeah, exactly. I was very aware after that, you know, I could be hit by the proverbial bus at any point.
So mortality, your own or others, is something that plays on your mind?
Yes, I mean, definitely. I mean, I think a recurring theme for me is how to live a meaningful life, and stories that circle around that subject are what pull to me most strongly.
You tried and failed to publish a couple of novels. You reckon you got about 80 rejections from agents and publishers over a decade. And then age 32, you sold your first novel. But I want to come to Dear Edward now, if I may, Anne, and ask you to explain to us. Here we are in 2020, but I need to go back 10 years to a plane crash which left one Dutch boy as the sole survivor in real life. Why did that story affect you so much?
It obsessed me, like, immediately. I think the strongest image that I have for why it did so was that there was a picture of the little boy. So it was a very famous plane crash in 2010, and the flight was from South Africa bound for London, and it crashed in Libya, and the only survivor was a 9-year-old Dutch boy. And they found him still buckled into his plane seat about a half mile away from the rest of the wreckage. And he had a punctured lung and a broken leg, but he was otherwise fine. And everyone else in the flight, including his parents and brother, died immediately. And so it was obviously, it gripped everybody. It was massive news. But there was a photo of him in his hospital bed, and he was so beautiful and so small and broken looking. And I just kept looking at that image and how he was going to be able to climb out of that hospital bed and how he was going to walk out of that hospital without his parents and his brother. Like, how was he going to be okay? And I had two little boys at the time. They were 1 and 3. And that was certainly part of it, where I just felt like I needed that little boy to be okay. And I couldn't imagine how it would take place. So I ended up writing a set of fictional circumstances in which that could be the case.
Which brings us close enough to Dear Edward, I suppose, because you're right. That's what I so found so utterly absorbing about your book, where it's one chapter is about the flight, and you really brought us onto the plane, and the next was about something completely different, which is Edward trying to survive in a crazy world and process what happened. So your book, while it is all about a plane crash, is not about a plane crash at the same time, exactly the same time, two peculiar plates spinning.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would be reticent to read a book about a plane crash because I am a skittish flyer.
Well, I find that bizarre that you would say that. We'll come to that in a minute. I'll let you finish the answer to this question before we get to that. Keep going.
Well, so I think I had to write a book that was about a plane crash that wasn't really about a plane crash.
And do you think you achieved that, Anne?
Well, I really don't think I'm the one to judge it, yeah. But people seem to feel that way, so I hope so, yes.
Okay, well, let's talk about the book then as a plot. Bring us on to the flight with Edward and his family, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, so the book starts with Edward and his brother Jordan and his parents boarding a flight in Newark, New Jersey. The flight is bound for Los Angeles, and his mother has gotten a new job in Los Angeles, so their family is actually relocating to the West Coast, so it's a big day and a big move. Hmm. And we get to know several other people on the flight too. So there's a octogenarian billionaire. There's a soldier on his way back from Afghanistan. There's a Wall Street dude. There is a mathematician. There's a woman who believes in reincarnation. So there's a lot of people whose heads we dip into.
The air steward, all these lives that, you know, when I'm reading it, I'm thinking, God, I often wonder who you're sitting beside on a bus or, you know, on a plane. And why we are so complicated as human beings. We're complicated novels. So within the flight, you have a series of almost novellas.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun for me, actually, because everyone flies. So I got to go into the heads of these very different from each other human beings. And during a day that for them is more or less normal. They don't know that the plane is going to crash for most of the flight. So they're enmeshed in their own lives and their own concerns. And one of them's taking a pregnancy test and two of the others are flirting fairly extensively.
And the rest?
Yeah, and the rest, yes.
Mm-hmm. So when I say on the rest, you know what I mean? As a flirting continues apace. Yes, you do, because you wrote it. And then you've got what I think is so intriguing. At one stage, you talk about the wealthy guy, Cox, and mm-hmm. how he's just all about money. And I'm picking up my copy of the book that I kept a few stickers on it of quotes that I liked in it. This is a woebegone idea because the money, I'm quoting your book now, without him attached to it, has no meaning, just green and white paper rectangles that he spent his whole life, his whole self, socking away. And yet we know, because of the nature of the book, from the very first page, we know it's doomed. What was it all for?
Yeah. I mean, that's
greed or something.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a mislived life in a certain sense, and him realizing it at the end of it. It was a lovely way to explore kind of like different ways to live life and different choices that are made. And what the ramifications of that are. Not in a, hopefully not in a morally judgmental way. I love Crispin Cox.
Yeah.
But just in a way of like, we're so different from each other. We make such different choices. And how you feel at the end of that run is a reflection of the choices that you made.
As the flight starts to experience a little bit of trouble, you see sort of like little icicles building on a wing, and you might, you, people might have seen such a thing. And in fairness, you keep it right till the end, so it's not, you know, it's the suspense is wonderful. And then the pilots are chatting away, and you just get this, because we know again that the flight's going down, but you get this sense of sickening doom, unavoidable. Did you speak to people in the, you must have, in the aeronautical world or the, your pilots or whoever, in terms of the black box transcript, where there's this awful realization between the two pilots that this is not rescuable?
Yeah, I mean, I extensively interviewed a career pilot, which was fascinating. And then I also read extensively like the National Transportation Safety Board reports, which include black box recordings from the flights that go down. And then there was one flight that I sort of used the reason that it crashed in the book, because it was very important to me not to sensationalize the crash. I wanted to make sure that it was accurate and felt true and felt real and solid.
Which it does.
And thank you. There was a flight, an Air France flight in 2009 from Rio de Janeiro bound for Paris, and it crashed into the ocean, and they didn't find the black box until 3 years later. And I sort of took the reasons for that crash and put it into my book.
I'm not sure if you're aware of this, but that flight you just mentioned has a really horrible association with this country, because three very young Irish doctors died on that flight.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, three, Doc Jane, DC, and Aisling Butler, and Ethna Walls, all graduated from medicine in Trinity in 2007 when we were returning home from holidays in Brazil. So I think it's, you know, thinking of their families today, actually, because Ireland is a small place and it's difficult for families. When you think of it, you just said in passing that you didn't want to sensationalize it, which I'm glad to say you didn't. I mean, I've never been in a plane crash, thank God, but you just seem to have, you know, when the plane does crash in this book, I didn't see a Hollywood blockbuster version of a plane crash in my head. I just saw a tragedy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was really important to me. I wanted to take it seriously because it is such a serious thing. If I was going to step on that ground, I wanted to step on it with research and properly and respectfully as possible.
And even the passengers, there's compassion there. They mightn't be all lovable, but not everyone's very lovable in life. You know, all of certain assets or facets that aren't beautiful, but you seem to infuse them with the character. Did you look at other people you knew for that, or did you pluck them out of your literary sort of brain?
I actually did I spent the first year of the book taking notes and doing research and thinking about it. So I wanted the passengers on the plane to be very different from each other. And then I read research books in fleshing them out more. So Crispin Cox, I read the biography of Jack Welch, who ran the company GE for about 30 years.
Okay.
And he, Straight from the Gut is the name of that book. And he's very spunky and very enthused with his work. And that was really helpful. And then David Foster Wallace wrote a book about math that I read for the father, who's a mathematician.
Yes.
I read War by Sebastian Younger, which is a wonderful nonfiction book for the soldier. And also I have a friend who's in the military who I spoke to. And then I actually read Neil Gaiman's The Sandman series while I was in the first year. And that inspired Florida, because Gaiman is so wonderful about sort of joyfully dropping boundaries of space, time, and every other boundary that you can think of. And I was like, oh, you know, why can't one of the passengers believe that she's had many lives? So I tried to dive into them as deeply as I could in order to make sure that they worked as very different people from each other.
Is your book about kindness?
I hope so, actually. I think that what I realized while I was writing it was, in order to make sure that Edward was going to be okay in the way that I really wanted the Dutch boy to be okay, it was going to require a kind world. And I also think that when something terrible happens, it brings out the best in us. We step forward with kindness. If a child walked into the room you're in right now, like dripping wet and looking scared, you would immediately rush to him or her and see if you could help. It's like it's a natural response inside of us. So I got to see like a lot of beauty in the humanity around him in a way that hopefully isn't cheesy, but is true and within us all the time.
For sure. It's a lovely note on which to end our conversation. Congratulations, Anne, on a wonderful book. I look forward to your next one already, but it was great to talk to you. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you. I really appreciate you talking with me.
Not at all. That's Anne Napolitano, author of Dear Edward, which I'd be shocked if you didn't enjoy that, to be honest with you. And it would be a cracking book club read, but it doesn't have to be that, but one for the bag if you're on the bus or the train or whatever you might be. I've thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it, so I hope you quite like that. 51551 is the text number. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back for more after this. Last year's Rugby World Cup didn't quite go as planned, with Ireland being beaten by the All Blacks in the quarterfinal. But this summer, Ireland will be hosting the Mixed Ability Rugby World Cup, and the Irish teams will be hoping they can do much, much better. It's a wonderful initiative that promotes inclusion and equality in sport. And two of the people involved are Alan Crockwell and James Healy, who are here this morning. Good morning, fellas, and thanks for coming in to see us.
Morning, Ryan.
Morning, Ryan.
What? Let's get straight down to business, Alan, about a little bit about yourself, because you're a co-founder of the first Mixed Ability Rugby team in Ireland.
Yes.
So why would you do such a thing?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Now I'm wondering why.
Go on.
In a good way. My day job, I work with Cope Foundation.
Oh yeah.
So I'm disability services manager, and look, I suppose there's always kind of an idea of how do you get people more involved in community or in sport. Sure. And how do you do that? And it's something that's I'm very passionate about, you know, letting people have the opportunity. You know, without providing the opportunity, you won't see anybody's ability. So that's very important. And I read an article in Rugby World magazine 2014, and as one of my co-founders, Lee Marr, would say, BC before Cropwell, life began after that, and Mixed Ability Rugby was born out of that. I knew he was involved with Sunday as well, rugby club at the time, and I went to him and I said, look, what do you think of this? Liam was also training for swimming the English Channel at the time, so this was in before we were getting in for a swimming session. Swimming is my main sport.
Okay.
So it was like, what do you think of this? And so he went to it and he brought it to the committee, and you know what, without hesitation, which to my surprise, you know, they just said, this seems like the right thing to do, let's just do it. That was 2014. 13 guys turned out Friday night. We now have about a roster of about 60 players.
Great, great.
Maybe our coach's nightmare, but like we'll handle that one.
It's a good news story, yeah, even massive. If it's hard work for Maeve and the gang. And what is a mixed ability rugby team, in practice?
Okay, so just think about rugby.
Yeah.
All right. And first thing that comes to mind, I suppose, for most people will be obviously the Six Nations and the professional game. But that's the 1%. The 99% of us just want to play social sport, and that's essentially what it is. It doesn't discriminate against disability or ability. The fact that if you kick the ball up high in the air to me, Ryan, I probably won't catch it.
That's for sure.
It'll bounce off me somewhere.
Yeah, likewise.
You'd be perfect.
Sure, as I often said, I retired from rugby at the age of 8 and became a post when they needed me sometimes.
Similar experience, but now I'm back playing.
So on the team, you've got all comers, really.
Yeah, so look, the whole idea is it's about not categorizing people, not labeling people.
Good.
So it differs in terms of, so, you know, okay, with disability sports, you know, there are options around, you know, Special Olympics and Paralympics. And then we just found, we hit on this, there is an appetite for people just to be involved in sport. And also really, really, what really surprised me is people coming back to the game, who may have retired or little time, or who've lost interest in the game, coming back into the sport just because it's more of a recreational or a social avenue for them. And like, it is competitive and we do play to the game, but like one of the main adaptations is uncontested scrums, you know.
Yes.
And that's just really because most of us aren't able to scrum or want to. So like essentially, mixed ability movement is about kind of activity, getting involved in activity, having fun, and having no barriers, just letting it open to everybody. And the magic really happens because you have people from all walks of life, all abilities, just coming together to play the game of three halves.
Half one, first half. Yeah. Half two, second half.
You
half three.
Question, James,
let's bring you into the mix here. What's the third half?
Into the bargain.
The 19th hole.
Yeah, well, that's if Connie opens it up then.
Okay, so, okay. James, James, let's talk to you. How did you get involved in all of this, please?
Alan came to myself and my buddy Danny. He's taller than me.
So, Paul O'Connell and Stringer.
That's what you guys are like, hanging out together. Yeah. And when the suggestion was made, do you fancy playing rugby, James? How did you feel about that?
I thought, you know, because I'm scared first, so I said to Alan, would he say it to my mum and dad first? Because when I was small, I had a kind of an accident. I fell out at home, I fell out the top window.
How old were you?
I was 3 years of age. Oh, and I was on the life support machine for 21 days. And the doctors and the nurses wanted to knock the life support machine. But my mother, father and family wouldn't leave me because they knew I was going to live. And I was born to play rugby.
You were meant to be hanging around here. I think that's the truth out of that story. And the rugby part of it then, when Alan approached your parents and said, can James play with us? Were you nervous of their answer?
Yeah, I was nervous.
What were you worried about?
I was afraid of them in case they say no.
I think I was more nervous of something than you were, to be honest.
And what did we now know. Obviously, the parents said yes. And
yeah.
So what position are you playing these days?
First, I was at the very start, I was playing on the wing. But then I went to the coach then and I said, could I change my position? Because out in the wing, I wasn't getting enough ball. But now I'm in as a hooker now, in front row, so I'm getting enough ball.
So you're right in the middle of it. Yeah, you look now stocky enough to be in the scrum now, I have to say. You don't look like a winger at all. In fact, I have to say, Alan, you look more like a winger than anything else.
Yeah, 15 and 8.
Yeah, okay.
I'm now promoted or demoted.
Okay, so you can be full-back wings, scrum half.
Oh, no, I'm putting the forwards so they can just be shoved around broad places. I'm happy enough with that.
What's the training like, James?
Very hard.
Is it? How often do you train every week?
Well, we train Tuesdays and Fridays in Musgrave Park on Fridays and in Silver Springs Inn on Tuesdays.
And you've been involved in the Special Olympics?
I have before.
Have you won medals?
I have.
In what?
Basketball.
So how does basketball compare to rugby then, or which do you prefer?
I prefer rugby because I get more opportunities, you know, with rugby than I did with basketball.
And do you have a memory on the pitch that is the most glorious favourite memory of them all?
For rugby?
Yeah.
When I was the first ever man in the match of the first tournament.
Congratulations.
That's pretty no mean feat,
I have to say. Congratulations to you on that. What do you do when you're not playing rugby? What's your week like? What do you get up to?
I hang around with my family and friends and that.
Sure. And do you do a bit of work as well?
Yeah, I'm working out in Vicar's Road in Co-op there in QDS.
Yeah.
And another part-time then I'm over across the road in the garage in Circle K.
And if I was to pull into Murphy's carriage in my car, what would you be able to do for me?
I'd probably put in petrol for you, or else I might give your car a wash.
Okay, I'll see you soon.
No, his partner in crime, Danny, is over there too.
So. Is this the Paul O'Connell?
Yeah, he'll wash the roof and James
will
wash the wheels.
So you got Paul O'Connell washing the roof and James. Peter Stringer washing the wheels.
Yeah.
So he's still like upstairs, downstairs.
The doors will just be a bit stripey, that's all. Like, you don't mind that.
Are you good at it?
Yeah.
You are good. Okay, I like to hear that. Because when we were in UCC last week, actually, we met some of your friends from Cope in the coffee shop there.
So yeah, that would be one of my other projects.
Is it?
Yeah. I wear many hats. So Roots Coffee Shop, you know, we're trying to just promote kind of get people into the real workplace and workplace and get skills, you know, learned up so that people can actually move on into.
You know, everyone brings something different to the table.
Yeah.
And if we don't share the table, well, how are we going to know
exactly
what everyone has in life? Yeah. What can they bring to our world? And that's why if we replace table with pitch, what you're doing is you're doing the right thing. And to start with 13, to currently have about 40 or thereabouts, suggests that this has traction. People want this to happen in the world.
And like, it didn't happen overnight. And, you know, it's 6 years in the making. You know, at the very start, I suppose you're walking people into a situation that they don't know anything about. And if you look at the RFU and, you know, trying to get the backing of them initially was you know, it was a process. We had to walk with them because this was ridiculous, ludicrous. You're putting people who are vulnerable onto a pitch to play a contact sport.
Yes.
What are you at? You know, they'll get hurt. You know, they're not able for it.
Health and safety.
And that is one of the big things around kind of, you know, if you have a barrier or disability, eventually you're going to become an Excel sheet. You know, and that's what's going to happen to you unless there's people out there that will actually provide the opportunity so people can show what they can do. And I suppose that's what drives me and it has driven me to where we are at. I know it's great to have the backing of the RFU for this tournament and great to say that, you know, they are looking at employing and interviewing for a disability inclusion officer for rugby and to promote all parts of the game.
Isn't that a great development? Yeah. I mean, that
very
just
proud of
opens
that.
Doors then. Yeah. And other also leading from the front, leading by example, means that other sporting disciplines will say, we need that.
Yeah.
We need to be doing that.
This is exactly what we're like. We've a tournament coming up in June, the 7th to 12th.
This is going to be huge.
It's people have no idea.
How Tell big us about this it. Is. The Mixed Ability Rugby World Cup.
So, the Mixed Ability World Cup, it's a tournament for mixed ability rugby teams from all around the world. So, there's 28 teams coming. And for the first time ever, four of them teams will be women's teams. This is the first women's tournament to be hosted at IMART 2020.
14 countries?
14 countries, about 1,000 players.
Great.
You know, you're talking from as far away as Argentina, Ecuador, all the home nations, you know, so it's going to be fun. Most of them we know anyway, or we've met them at some stage.
Yeah, there's a lot of travel involved.
Yeah, we've had a lot of...
James, have you travelled about the place, James? What countries did you like to go to?
Well, I've been to England, Italy, Wales, Belgium, Spain, Galway, Dublin... Belfast.
So that's abroad from when you're from Cork. That's
Dublin is like another country in some ways. Yeah. What was your favourite country outside Ireland?
It's hard to say.
But you've got this. This is back to what we were saying earlier on, an opportunity to travel in a way that you mightn't have before. What are you looking forward to about the World Cup?
Trying to win back our title again.
Who are you trying to win it off?
The Argentinians.
Yeah. Do you think you can do it this time?
I say so.
If you keep those cars, I mean, who needs the gym? Like, that's a lot of muscle being built up there, I'm sure, to keep that going and to win it back. It's all happening on the 7th to the 12th of June in 2020, taking place in a few venues?
Yeah, Irish Independent Park will be the main venue for the matches, but we'll also be hosting a conference in UCC that'll be kind of showcasing mixed ability and how we can transfer this model across sports, but also into what we're finding is the business community. This is, you know, everybody's talking, the buzzword is inclusion.
Good.
But the people who know all about it are sitting here in front of you. And we've been in plenty of businesses.
Are they responding well?
Yeah. Like, I mean, they really, you know, they understand that we actually are the leaders in this. It's the field that's going to run the boardroom, really, in terms of that. So the response is very good in terms of their diversity and inclusion policies. And, you know, so we're hoping and we're championing that. We have some headline speakers, you know, like the likes of Ian McKinley, John Flynn from HSBC, around ex-CEO. So it'll be a great lift for organisations to come and come to that conference. Also, we have exhibition events, you know, rowing and boxing and a sport called kinball, which you wouldn't be very familiar.
No, not
it's
at
like
all.
A big beach ball that has to be brought from one place to another by having everybody's hands on it.
I'd still be rubbish at that. Yeah. It's like pass the ball.
And again, like this is something that's going to attract a lot of people, a lot of interest. Great. You know, we've managed to secure funding from Europe. So it's part funding, so you know we still have a gap to close, so if anybody's out there wants to close it,
how would they help you close it?
imartworldcup.org.
imart, I-M-A-R-T worldcup.org. And just a business, particularly in the Cork area,
anywhere,
you'll take it anywhere.
The James and Alan show will do any inclusion training with anybody at any stage.
Well, I've enjoyed your show. Now, are you going to be scoring some tries and maybe man of the match again, James?
Made a mistake on the very first one.
Go on.
I was running so fast that I ended up running over the ball line.
Oh, come on. You're so enthusiastic. Yeah, okay.
That was against the clan.
But you know what? If you're going to do that once, the great thing about that is you'll know not to do it again.
Yeah.
You got it. Okay.
Well, there'll be a court fine if you do it again.
Fellas, it's been great to see you both. We'll keep an eye on that. And we'll make sure we'll keep one posted as to when it's on, a bit closer
to
the time.
To come down.
Well, if I'm in that zone, in that part of town, I'd be more than happy to come along and support.
We'll get you a coffee too from
that.
Roots.
Well, from my old pals there. I'd like that very much. Thank you very much. Alan Crocker, lovely to meet you.
Thank you, right.
James Healy, superstar and rugby legend. Nice to see you. And thanks for coming to see us this morning.
You.
All right. The text number is always 51551. Glance at any NYPD roster and you'll be reminded of the long tradition of Irish-American officers in the ranks. And my next guest carries that heritage proudly, and well he might, from patrolman to top brass. Terry Monaghan is the NYPD's chief of department. It's their highest ranking uniformed officer. He joins us from New York. Terry, good morning. Nice to talk to you today.
Good morning, Ryan. Pleasure to talk to you.
I couldn't mention Terry Monaghan, and I won't without asking about Ireland and its importance in your life, or otherwise, by the way. You don't have to say you love Ireland if you don't.
I love Ireland. I was there just this earlier this last summer. What a great place. I'm looking forward to getting back there.
And do you have a connection to the country, going back a bit?
Absolutely. You know, as an Irishman, an Irish cop, which is a tradition, started with my grandfather back in 1927, he became a New York City police officer in the tradition of an Irish cop. And same as my father back in the 40s. And I trace my roots back to, on my mother's side, to Galway and my father to Cavan.
Galway, Cavan. So you're Galway, all up the west coast there. Well, listen, this is already a good news story. So that's your credentials are well and truly intact. It's funny, isn't it, when you talk about the Irish-American cop. You know, you write down to cartoons, whether it was Top Cat or if it's movies, whether it's The Godfather, the cop is always as an Irish brogue. Why is that?
Listen, it became the profession for the Irishmen when they came to New York City back in the early 1900s. And, you know, it's something that I've always wanted to be, I guess, just growing up. You know, you saw the Irish cop and, you know, my neighborhood, I had a bunch of my friends and we all decided to become cops together. And for me, it's just been a tradition to keep up that tradition of the good old Irish cop. And you look at the agency, we have Commissioner Shea, we have Commissioner O'Neill, Bratton. So the Irish still help run this New York City Police Department.
That's for sure. I was over there recently. I was talking to the Consul General, and he was telling me that at one point, in somewhere like Five Points and certain parts in New York, you'd have 30% of the population were Irish-born. So the presence is enormous.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's still a large Irish presence in New York. Listen, we're a very diverse city. We have people from all over the world in the city, and same as our police department, but the Irish still have a pretty strong stronghold here in New York City.
You joined in 1982, is that right, the 41st Precinct?
That's correct.
Okay, when you get in there as a young man, ambitious, lofty hopes and aims and ideals, what greets you when you walk through the door? Can you recall it?
Oh, it was a tough city back then. 1982, New York City was nothing like it is today. There was a lot of violence. You know, I started in the 4-1 precinct, and the place was burnt down. The station house that I worked on Simpson Street, it was the only building still standing on that block. Everything else had burnt down from the fires of the 70s that devastated New York City. And the 4-1 was, you know, it was evident of it. You know, you went to the Hunts Point section of the 4-1 precinct, there was, on every corner you turned, there was prostitution. Prostitutes out on the street. The quality of life there was tough. It was a difficult time as a New York City cop. But we made a lot of changes over my 38 years, and the city is a completely different place right now.
It is amazing. It's a city I love. I visited quite a lot, and I always feel safe there for some reason. I don't know if that's in the last 20 years, but you describe almost a dystopian Black Mirror version of New York City. I mean, being a cop in the middle of all of that, was it dangerous or was it exciting in its challenge?
Listen, as a young cop, it was exciting. But it was a dangerous job. And being a cop, no matter where you're a police officer, whether you're here in New York, whether you're in Ireland, it's a dangerous profession. And it takes a certain individual to become a New York City police officer or a police officer anywhere in the world. You know, you dedicate your life to taking care of others. You put your own life at risk for others. So it's just part of what the profession is. It's part of what we do in law enforcement around the world.
You would have been part then of the generation of cops who cleaned up the city, to use the expression. And we, I mean, from a distance across the water, we'd look and would have thought of Rudy Giuliani when he was, I suppose, a different character, if you like, to the one he is now in some ways, regardless of your politics. He just has evolved in that way. And as mayor of New York City, the zero tolerance mayor, was that a game changer, or do you think it would have happened anyway?
No, that was a game changer. Back in 1994, when Mayor Giuliani took over, and more importantly, Commissioner Bratton took over and actually gave meaning to what we did in police work, that realized that focused police work would make a difference in neighborhoods, that having cops go out there with a reason, not just going out haphazardly, focused on individuals of crime, holding commanders responsible for crime in their area, saying that we can make a difference, that police matter, it really did change the entire scope. You know, for years, prior to Commissioner Bratton coming in, we were not allowed to make street narcotics arrests. It was considered a potential for corruption. So street narcotics was rampant in New York City. But in 1994, that all changed. And we started doing what needed to be done to take this city back, to get the city under control, to get us down from 2,240 homicides down to where we are now of around 300 a year. That was the difference of the renaissance of New York City.
Sure, sure. And what a renaissance it was. And then you suddenly see it. New York has this profound influence on the United States of America, despite its size relative to the rest of the country. And I think about that because the former mayor, Mike Bloomberg, is potentially in the shakedown for the Democratic nomination for the presidency. And yet, what came to bite him back from the depths of time in the last few days was his comments about African Americans being stopped and searched as a policy. And he was talking about the numbers of African Americans, just do the math sort of thing. Do you think that sometimes you can get it wrong?
Yeah, you can. And as an agency, you know, we had progressed from where we were in the 90s and what we did, and we kept going in the same direction. You know, again, I'll go back to something Commissioner Bratton had always said. It's almost like a cancer patient. Mm-hmm. You had to apply chemotherapy to the patient, but if you applied too much to that patient, you would injure the patient. So that's what we did as we went into the 2000s. You know, stop and question became a measure of productivity as opposed to the actual tool that it is. And we use it way, way too much. And as we showed, moving on from there, over the last 6 years, we were able to reduce that activity and still continue to reduce crime. Because it's a constitutionally protected right for police officers, but it never should be used as a productivity tool.
And one of the defining images of our times was the men and women in uniform on that awful morning of 9/11. Where were you that day?
I was actually at home when the plane hit. I was taking my kids to school, and I heard it on the news, and I had to quickly come in, get changed. I was eerie feeling. I was crossing the George Washington Bridge, and I was the only car on the bridge at that point. And you could see the smoke and everything coming from downtown. That day, I spent up in the Washington Heights section. That's where I was a commanding officer, trying to get people out of the city through the George Washington Bridge. And it was the next day I spent down there at Ground Zero. Just the devastation, it was unreal. You know, as a city, to see how we've bounced back from that, it's just tremendous.
There's about 23 police officers from your NYPD killed on that day. And then another 240 plus members of the force with 9/11 related illnesses. That's not something that gets talked about a lot here, at least. The impact was probably devastating, I presume, on the force for some time.
Absolutely, and it still is. You know, that 240 is each and every year. We're losing more and more, and there are more currently sick with 9/11 related cancers. It's something that's not going away. That number grows each and every year. We lose more and more officers. We're putting 30-some-odd officers up on our memorial wall each and every year right now, and it's just about almost entirely 9/11-related illnesses.
That's quite shocking. I think I saw John Stewart, the TV presenter, seems to be involved in that campaign on that subject. And it's an ongoing story, clearly. Are people being looked after enough, or is it just an awful casualty of that attack?
It's a casualty of that attack. Listen, what happened, the toxins that were in that air that day, for anyone that was down there, and our men and women were down there each and every day, us along with the fire department, a lot of construction workers, it takes time. It takes time for that cancer to develop in your system, and that's what's happened to these individuals that were down there 19 years ago, and they're getting sick. Some of it's happening now, and like I said, each and every year, we're losing people. The fire department's losing people. You know, John Stewart did a tremendous, tremendous job working with us to get a bill passed to make sure that anyone who does get sick from 9/11-related diseases, that they're covered. That the compensation fund, the World Trade Center Compensation Fund, will take care of them and take care of their families.
Did you ever dream, Terry, when you were a young cop going through those doors in that awful city of New York as it was then, and when I said by awful, you know, the way you described it, did you ever think you'd end up wearing those badges you're wearing today as the chief?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Listen, I was a young, aggressive cop, having a lot of fun out on the streets. You know, eventually I took a promotion exam. I moved up to the agency. Did I ever think I would be the chief of the department? Nah. Things just happen. They happen for a reason. I guess just being a good, solid Irishman helped move me up through the agency.
Yeah.
And I'm honored to be in this position, honored to work with the 36,000 uniformed members that we have in this agency. They're some of the best in the world, along with 19,000 civilians that we have working for us.
Let me ask you, best bit, worst bit. What is the worst, most difficult part of your job, for starters?
The worst part is when we lose an officer.
Sure.
When we have an officer shot in the line of duty, to sit down, to deal with the families, to get to know those families, because they are part of our families forever, the families of our fallen. You know, the Lisa Tizzulos, Leanne Simonson, you know, their husbands gave their lives for what we do. And to sit there in the hospital and have to break the news to them, that is without a doubt the toughest thing that you'll ever do. And it's something that, you know, it will stay with you forever.
And then at the completely other end of the spectrum then, when you get up in the morning, Terry, what gives you most joy in that uniform as chief?
Going out there and seeing how the vast majority of people just really do respect the police. No matter what you read in the media, no matter what you see, I walk to events and people thank you. They thank you for what you do. They thank me for the work that my men and women do each and every day. You know, no matter how negative you may read things, the appreciation is there. I'll give you a quick story going back. Sure. In 2014, there were tons of demonstrations in the city, you know, anti-police demonstrations. And on one New Year's Eve, I had to walk around with these demonstrators, maybe 100 or so, basically cursing me out for 2 or 3 hours. Finished with that, and I walked up to Times Square. And there were a million people there. And every step I took, someone there thanked me, appreciated what we did as an agency. So it's that understanding that though there may be negative out there, the vast, vast, vast majority of people respect and like the police department.
You're due here in Ireland for the International Fraud Prevention Conference in Dublin with a Q&A in Croke Park on March the 11th, which is close enough to St. Patrick's Day. I'm sure it's a parade and an event you're not unfamiliar with. So do you like coming back to Ireland, or is that a little obvious as questions go?
Oh, I love coming back to Ireland. I had such a fun time there during the summer. I am really looking forward to coming to this conference, sitting down with some leaders around the world, discussing the issues, but then also spending a few times, and I might have a pint of Guinness somewhere along the line.
It's been good to talk to you. I hope our paths cross at some point, either there or here, but we'll talk again, I've no doubt.
All right, thank you, Ryan.
Thanks for your time today. That's Chief Terry Monaghan, NYPD Chief of Department. Lovely taste of Irish Americana there this morning. The text number 51551.